Bill 2964. Dan, would you update us on this? And Marty, do you want to come up, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2964. You should have in front of you the Dash 4 amendment. And Dash 4 amendment prohibits the DMV from refusing to issue a renewal or supplemental vehicle dealer certificate based upon revocation or suspension of a vehicle dealer certificate in another jurisdiction. As best I understand it, it has no revenue impact on the basic bill plus the Dash 2 and Dash 4 amendments. And I don't have a read on the fiscal impact yet, but we do have a representative from DMV here as well. Also, the proponent has indicated that they'd like to move both the Dash 2 and the Dash 4 amendment to House Bill 2964.
There's a Dash 2 and a Dash 4. Is that what you're saying, Dan?
Yep. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
And Monty's got a sheet.
Okay, Monty.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if you look at the thing that has my logo on the front of it, that's my testimony. Right behind that is the Dash 2 amendment. Right behind that is the Dash 4 amendment. And right behind that is the bill with the Dash 2 and 4 is put in it.
Okay, that's off the sheet here.
Yes, sir. And I have worked all the kinks out of it to everybody's satisfaction, DMV and new car dealers and manufactured housing and our guys. Basically, we've made sure that a currently licensed vehicle dealer here in Oregon is not affected by the ability of DMV to prohibit somebody coming in from out of state and getting a license when they are currently revoked in another state.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Johnson?
Mr. King, would you amplify on that a little bit? That I'm not quite sure I understand what you just said.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, there is no clearinghouse of car dealers in the United States. So if somebody from Texas was revoked there for stealing hundreds of thousands of dollars, they got their license revoked, they could drive into Oregon DMV and get a dealer's license, and there isn't really a lot we could do about it.
That piece of it I understand, but creates exemption for existing Oregon dealers. That's the piece that I'm confused on.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, right now, we figure if you're doing business in Oregon and you're legal in Oregon, you're doing all the right stuff in Oregon, if you had a separate license, say, in California, and for some reason an employee of yours did some bad stuff and that license got revoked, that should not affect your current dealer's license in Oregon.
Thank you.
Tell us what these amendments do, Marty.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I didn't...
Tell us what these amendments do.
In the Dash 2 amendment, changes the inspection requirement of DMV from a shall inspect every car dealer to may inspect every car dealer to give them more flexibility in their inspection process to come up with some new ideas on how to do inspections. But we do want to make sure it's known that we expect dealers to be inspected whenever DMV wants to inspect them. And that's to make sure the industry stays clean, so the money the DMV collects for the state on vehicle titling and licensing is handled properly. It's just a lot more flexible for DMV to have a may than a shall, and there is no opposition from DMV on that. They still have all the rights to inspect anybody they want, anytime they want, but now they don't have to do it in a reasonable time frame. They can do it when they feel it's necessary.
Okay, how about the Dash 4s?
Mr. Chairman, the Dash 4s clarify it's not really an exemption, but clarify the grandfathering of Oregon dealers in so that they don't lose their license if something happens in another state in one of their other dealerships.
Okay, so someone who is licensed in Oregon and currently carries a license in Oregon and who has their license revoked or suspended in another state would not fall within the purview of the statute, the bill. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
All right, and how about the paragraph 9 on the Dash 4s?
On the Dash 4s, that further clarifies because it's not only a question of getting a new license, but of renewing your license you have. Because in Oregon, when you get a if you're a current vehicle dealer and you want a second lot, if you want to run that second lot under a different name, you have to get a brand-new dealer's license under 822.020. You cannot just get another one under 822.040. So it clarifies that it's new licenses for new lots within Oregon and renewals of those, so that there's no question at all that they're not going to be taken out by something that happens in another state while they're currently licensed in Oregon.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. King?
Yes.
Yes, Representative Montes Anderson.
On your dashboard, number 9, I'm not sure I understand the way I read it. It says that if someone has their license suspended in another state, that what group cannot hold that against issuing a current valid certificate in this state? So if someone committed fraud and had their license suspended in California, they could still come here and get a license from the state of Oregon and have a dealership?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Montes Anderson, that would not be correct. If they are not currently licensed in Oregon and they get revoked in California, they cannot come here and get a license. Now, if they already have a business here in Oregon and they also have a business in California, and that California license gets revoked,
okay, if
they
you
can
have a
keep
dual
their Oregon one.
Okay.
Going.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Monty.
I just wanted to mention that this was probably my last bill of the session in front of you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, that's, we appreciate that. It's been a long project.
That's too bad.
Anybody else would like to give testimony on the amendments to House Bill 2964? If not, we will. Oh, we're in work session. So we're not closing anything. We're reopening the work session. Okay. Chair will entertain a motion on the dash twos. Senator Johnson?
I would move the dash twos into House Bill 2964.
Thank you. Representative Johnson moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 2964. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Johnson?
I would move the dash fours to House Bill 2964.
Representative Johnson moves the dash four amendments to House Bill 2964. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I would move the amended House Bill 2964 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Johnson moves House Bill 2964 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Okay, please call the roll.
Representative Bates? Excused. Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Devlin?
Excused.
Excuse. Representative Garrard?
Excused.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Knope?
Aye.
Representative Crummel?
Aye.
Representative Montes Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Walker?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye. House Bill 2964, as amended, goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there a volunteer for a carrier?
Well, I'll carry this, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I was just reading my notes from Mr. King's last testimony. I said, why let scumbags from another state into Oregon?
You're going to use that quote on the floor?
I'm going to use that quote on the floor.
Oh, boy. You got to always be careful. If Representative Walker is on the committee, every word that you say appears in written format. Okay, Representative Walker will carry the bill, and we will close the work session on House Bill 2964. Open a work session on House Bill 2764. And Dan, bring us up to date on that bill, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2764, what you should have behind the staff measure summary is, in fact, a fiscal that was not available when we looked at the dash 3 amendment, a dash 4 amendment, and a dash 5 amendment. The dash 5 amendment I did not receive in sufficient time to encapsulate onto the staff measure summary, but I did take the have the opportunity to take a look at the dash 4 amendment, where it in fact is different than the dash 3 amendment, which was the last version that you saw. I put it in bold face on the face of your staff measure summary. It's essentially the dash 4 amendment on page 7 of the dash 4 amendment, lines 23 through 31, does three things. In addition to what you saw in the dash three amendment, it exempts a loan originator employed by a mortgage banker who sells their services, FHA,
You're talking about the fours compared to the threes?
That's correct. The dash four compared to the dash three. It adds that it exempts a loan originator who sells FHA, Fannie Mae, or loan mortgage corporation loans. Secondly, it grants DCBS the authority to exempt a person from the requirement to register as a loan originator. And third, it permits voluntary registration of a loan originator for any person exempted within Section 3. With that, we have Mr. McCulley and some other folks that can answer any questions. And also, Mr. Carlson, correction, Mr. Cosgrove, to discuss the dash five amendment.
Tell me about the, again, take us through the changes in the dash four. Did you write this up on a staff summary?
I did. It's on the summary. Please turn to page 7 of the dash four amendments.
Where's the summary, Dan? Is this the summary here?
That's it, right there.
Okay.
And I put it in boldface as to what the changes are, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Okay. Those are the three things that you'll see within the first portion of Section 3 on page 7. Essentially, it starts with the large B, where, in fact, it exempts a loan originator employed by a mortgage banker. The large C, where it allows the director to exempt by rule or order. And the last portion there, where it does not prohibit any voluntary registration. Those three bullets are the difference between the dash four and the dash three.
All right, and what do we know about the dash fives at this point?
You have them in your packet, and in fact, if I could refer you to the dash five, to the top of page 2.
Sorry.
The top of page 2 for the dash five amendment, the definition of loan originator does not include an insurance agent or insurance consultant, or an individual whose responsibilities are clerical administrative functions. In essence, what this change does, this dash five amendment does, is it exempts those insurance agents who are also loan originators. And again, that's at the top of page 2, the first two lines.
Is that the only change between the fours and the fives?
No, the fives do not have those items that are in the four on page 7, the dash four amendment. Those exempting of loan originators that sell FHA and Fannie Mae type loans, and the voluntary registration.
The fives don't have that.
The fives do not have that.
The fives are different from the threes to the extent of the top of page 2.
That's correct.
But they do not have what is the changes that are in the fours relative to the threes.
That's correct.
Okay.
So I have a question, if I could. Mr. Clum, do you have any idea just how many people are exempted under this bill now? There seems to be a lot.
The proponents of the amendments can speak to the number, but in fact, I think Mr. McCulley has got some facts and figures. Somewhere along the line of an additional 1,000 people would be exempted that were also insurance agents. So, in fact, there's some. This amendment was, I think it was requested originally by Representative Devlin, who may want have a chance to speak to it as well.
Okay, let's have Mr. McCulley come forward, please, and respond to any questions or add whatever comments you would like about the fours or the fives.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm John McCulley, representing the Oregon Association of Mortgage Brokers. We are the ones who brought you the dash four amendments, and after the last work session that you had on the bill and in my other conversations with members of the committee, it was clear that there was a desire on the part of many members of the committee to have us try to work out an agreement with the mortgage bankers on this legislation. We think we have accomplished that in the dash four amendments. In the sections that you see, we believe that this exemption would apply only to a handful of people. I would say fewer than 10 companies in the state would be affected by these amendments in the dash fours. What they accomplish is they establish in lines 23 through 27 an exemption for those who are sellers or servicers of these federal loans, and as a result they are subject to some specific and significant standards. There are audit requirements involved with that, so we believe that there is a significant oversight of that group of people, even though they would not be covered under this legislation. there may be extraordinary circumstances that also exist, and that's why you see the language that is on line 28 on page 7, giving the director discretion by rule or order for other people. But again, we believe that fewer than 10 companies are going to be affected by the Dash 4 amendments. And I guess I can add that Mr. Marquis has authorized me to say that with the adoption of the Dash 4 amendments, that his client, the Mortgage Bankers Association, is no longer opposed to the bill. And he's in the room, and of course you can verify that with him if you'd like.
He's going to come forward. Hopefully say just what you said.
I hope you said what
you said.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Marquis on behalf of the Oregon Mortgage Bankers Association, and Mr. McCulley is accurate. With the adoption of the Dash 4 amendments, the Oregon Mortgage Bankers Association has voted to change their position to neutral on this bill. And we have, I might add that we have no position on the Dash 5s because we don't have members that are affected by those.
Thank you. Representative Johnson?
He just answered my question.
Representative Crummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Marquis, on Big C, on line 28, how important is that in your estimation? On page 7.
What are you, on the Dash 4s,
Representative? Yes, on the Dash 4s. Page 7, line 28, exempted by the director by rule or order.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummel, though that is part of the amendment that we agreed to and is really was part of the negotiation process between the two associations. The amendment that's been adopted here, or that would be adopted here in terms of Big B, preceding the one you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
Really takes out Portland Mortgage and most of the large mortgage companies. There are some people that may not fit in that are in niche kind of situations that really don't deal with consumers. I did speak with the department about this, and this language is identical to language that's in many of their other licensing statutes, where if they find some extraordinary situation, they can exempt somebody because it's not in the public interest to make them toe the line on a licensing requirement. And I think they're pretty judicious about that. But that's an absolute, I mean, we really would like to see that there. That's very important to us.
Okay. Follow-up, Mr. Chair. So could the director then exempt the folks that are listed in wherever it is in the Dash 5s that takes out the licensed insurance agents that occasionally write mortgages as well?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummel, you're asking me a question about how the department might function, and I really I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer that. They are here, and that might be better to ask them.
Would you like
to
answer that question to them, Representative?
Yes, I would.
Yeah, please.
Wow, great time. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Jim Kruger. I'm the program manager for the Mortgage Lender Program in the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And if I understand the representative's question correctly, you're asking if the provision in the Dash 4 amendment would allow us to exempt out those people in the Dash 5? The answer is it probably would give us authority to do it, and we would do it provided we felt that there was a reason to do it. There has to be some basis for doing it. We're not going to exempt people out simply for the fact that they happen to be regulated by another department or division.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Carlson?
Thank you. So I think it's best to John McCulley. I have a fiscal impact statement for the Dash 3. I think is that the latest fiscal that we have? We don't have one on the Dash 4. And so I was curious if it's cut the scope down in terms of the revenues that you're going to be able to garner from this bill. How does that affect, how does that impact you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, it may be better for Mr. Krueger to comment on that,
okay,
since their department would do, or division would do, the fiscal.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, the Dash 4 amendments would have hardly any impact at all because the numbers of people who would be carved out are very, very small.
Okay.
The Dash 5 amendments probably would have an impact. I had estimated approximately 4,000 loan officers. With the Dash 5 amendments, I can think of probably 1,500 or so that would not be required to be registered as a loan officer were Dash 5 to be approved and become law. That would reduce the revenues by $50 every 2 years by the number of people who would no longer be required to register. And I have just seen that amendment also, and I haven't been able to give any thought to what it would do to expenditures. I don't know if having that many people out would allow us to reduce the number of FTE that we would devote to that program. Probably it would reduce by a half, but I'd have to take a closer look at it.
Yeah.
Sounds like you don't have a definitive number yet, but is it your sense that you could do the program under the Dash 4 or the Dash 5s without raising the fee that's anticipated by this from $50 to a higher level?
Yeah, Representative Carlson, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McCulley, this bill has a significant fiscal. Assuming it passes here, is it going to Ways and Means?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that's up to the committee. I'm assuming that at some point in this process, it's going to have to go to Ways and Means because it is going to require two 1.75 FTE, and with that expenditure, in addition to the revenue that comes in to cover the expenditure, so they've got an expenditure limitation issue they've got to deal with. So I'm not sure if this committee wants to send it there or if it's going to, but at some point it's going to have to make
what
that stop.
What is the fiscal on this thing?
Well, the Dash 3, Mr. Chair.
And the fourth would be about the same.
According to Mr. Krueger, there would be little change between the Dash 3 and the Dash 4. And you also indicated the Dash 5 would have some sort of a dramatic change to what is in front of us.
What do you have on the three?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the effect on revenues is $200,000 in the next biennium, and the effect on expenditures is $156,000 plus for a potential of 1.75 FTE. Am I reading this? I guess it's 2 FTE for the next biennium.
2 FTE, Mr. Chairman.
And it's approximately the same the biennium after that.
Yeah, Representative Johnson, would be my preference to send the bill to the floor and then have it go to Ways and Means on the other side before it goes to a substitute. It's got fees built into it that more than cover the system.
Respectfully, I might not share that opinion.
Other questions?
Just to follow up on that physical, the way I read it, fees are going to bring in $200,000, and then you say expenditures are $156,000, and so what? Is that correct?
That's correct, ma'am, Mr. Chair.
And then follow up, Mr. McCulley. Then. With all the people exempted, are you sure that physical will be 200,000 with the Dash 4?
Mr. Chair, I represent Melissa Anderson. We believe that the Dash 4s do not exempt that many people, so I don't believe there will be a dramatic impact on the fiscal statement, either on the revenue side or the expenditure side, just because there are not that many people who are actually affected by the Dash 4 amendments.
How about the Dash 5?
As Mr. Krueger stated, Mr. Chair, Representative Monis Anderson, that would have a more dramatic impact.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you. Let's have Mr. Cosgrove come up, please, and talk about the Dash 5.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Kosker, representing Primerica Financial Services Home Mortgages, Inc. Primerica is an interesting company in that it is a subsidiary of a national bank, Citibank. But this particular, and Citibank owns insurance companies and other financial services companies. This particular subsidiary is a licensed Oregon mortgage broker. I've recently been retained by them. They are not members of either of the two associations, and I think that's why they're a little late to the table. Primerica it works with 1,190 independent contractors who are, in fact, employees of another Citicorp subsidiary, an insurance company. Those people, amongst their duties, sell insurance. They are licensed Oregon insurance agents or consultants. Many of them are also licensed Oregon securities brokers under Chapter 59, and as thus they are regulated by Mr. Krueger's division as well as by the insurance division. But this bill, because of their activities occasionally in referring people to financial institutions that are other Citicorp subsidiaries, would also require them to be licensed in a third way as loan originators. Briefly, they do not do the full scope of what loan originators would do for other mortgage brokers. They simply, as part of dealing with their clients, and after talking about the other financial products they have, they may suggest that a loan is appropriate. Sometimes they are taking applications for unsecured loans, which would not be affected by this bill. Sometimes they are taking applications for mortgages, which would cause them to be licensed. And if the department's estimate of 4,000 is correct, then about 30% of all people covered by this bill would be these 1,200 people who work with Primerica, and thus it's a significant impact on the company. As insurance agents, and I've more specifically delved into the insurance licensing statute since that applies to all of them, they are already subject to criminal background checks, to fingerprinting, to all of the things that this bill would require a loan originator to do in terms of honesty and forthrightness and whether they've been disciplined by any agency. They are also subject to losing their insurance license if they violate any rule of the director. And in that statute, the director means the director of the whole department. So if they violated any of the mortgage banking rules as well as insurance rules, they would lose their insurance agent's license. Our Dash 5 amendments, as described by your staff, differ from the Dash 4 only on the top of page 2, and it creates an exemption for these licensed Oregon insurance agents and consultants. This is exactly what I understand both Minnesota and Texas did when it adopted mortgage broker loan originator registration statutes. So there's a precedent for handling this problem in this way, and we would suggest that based on the fact that they do not write mortgages full-time and therefore the impact of this fee is greater on them than it is on other full-time mortgage broker loan originators, that it's appropriate given that they're already licensed by one, if not two, other state agencies in this state, the same department, that the exemption would be appropriate. I'd be glad to answer any questions about the Dash 5s.
Paul, how about other provisions under the bill, such as the continuing education requirement? Would these folks have some kind of a comparable requirement as it relates to mortgage loans under their current licensing requirements, or would this be essentially new?
Mr. Chairman, they, as licensed Oregon insurance agents or as licensed Oregon securities brokers, have continuing education requirements in those subject areas already. They do not have continuing education requirements as in mortgage products, although the company internally has obviously its own educational efforts. The reason that I think that that's appropriate, we already have insurance agents exempted from this process. Ironically, if you are now an insurance agent working directly for an insurance company, you're outside the licensing statute, the continuing education, and the registration altogether. We just have this group of insurance agents who are not working for the insurance subsidiary, which would make them exempt. They are, in fact, working for the mortgage broker subsidiary, which makes them covered by the bill. So it puts them in the same position as lots of other people who are already exempted from those continuing education requirements.
Under this bill?
Correct.
Such as people who would work for banks or credit unions?
Banks or credit unions or insurers. Insurers are already exempt from licensure under mortgage broker banker statutes.
Okay.
Questions
for Mr. Cosgrove?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cosgrove, the fee is only $50 every 2 years. Isn't that correct?
Representative Walker, Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, that is correct. This subsidiary, its 1,200 employees, wrote an awful lot of unsecured loans and wrote an awful lot of insurance policies, but they wrote in the last calendar year 400 mortgages that would be covered. So for those 400 mortgages, this $50 equates to $150 per mortgage if you talk about 1,200 people paying $50 for 400 mortgages. So the impact of this fee per mortgage is significant, even though the fee itself is low. They also pay fees as insurance agents and for those who are also licensed as security brokers, as security brokers to the same agency of state government.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions for Mr. Cosgrove? Mr. McCulley, would you like to comment on the dash 5? Paul, you might stay up there in case there's more questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John McCulley, Oregon Association of Mortgage Brokers. We do have some concerns about the dash 5 just because of the number of people who, of course, would be not covered by the bill. We're also concerned that we're dealing with a group of people who are, I guess, involved in the mortgage business not full-time, and it would be our concern that people in that status probably have a greater chance, greater propensity to make some of the mistakes that we're concerned that are being made that hurt consumers. Now, I'm not sure the extent to which they're involved in the loan process, and Mr. Cosgrove and I have been talking about that, but nonetheless, it is worrisome that people who don't do this as a career may not keep up with the requirements of the law. That is, and we believe that it's important that they do have that background and training that would be required under House Bill 2764. In addition, if those people are merely taking an application, which I understand is the case in certain circumstances, I don't believe they would be covered under the legislation anyway. The definition of loan originator that you see on page 1 of the bill says that they have as their primary job responsibility negotiating with the borrower or potential borrower for the purpose of establishing terms and conditions of a loan. If they are merely taking an application and that's all they do, and they are not establishing terms and conditions of the loan, then I don't believe they fit the definition as exists in the proposed amendments now.
Were you done?
Oh, no, I was...
Whichever one, go ahead.
Well, I want Mr. Kruger to answer that question since he's the one that's going to be determining that.
Mr. Kruger, yeah, could you come forward again, please?
So, you were going to
ask? Mr. Chair, at some point, too, I'd be glad to describe more fully what these people who work for my client actually do.
Mr. Chair, for the record, again, my name is Jim Kruger. I'm the program manager for the Mortgage Lender Program. And I'm not sure I understand which question is being addressed to me.
The question being addressed to you, Mr. Kruger, is that Mr. McCulley says that under the definition of the term loan originator, Mr. Cosgrove's clients would not qualify and therefore wouldn't have to be subject to the bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, in the past, the agency has taken the position that if an application is taken or received by an individual, that's enough to trigger the mortgage lender law. It's not necessary for them to actually negotiate terms or negotiate on behalf. We have made that distinction because we have a great number of people who do telemarketing of mortgage loans. And they use abusive sales practice, and but they're asking for information upon which a credit decision is going to be made, and that's what the definition of an application is under federal law, and we follow that. That gives us the handle we need to get at those bad players. If we took the position that you actually had to negotiate some of the terms of the loan before you fell into the law, we would not be very effective as regulators, and consumers wouldn't have very much protection. So I think Mr. McCauley's answer was a little bit more narrow than I would be comfortable with.
And I have a follow-up question, if I could. Mr. Kruger, you and I have worked together on an interim work group, or, well, actually, a session work group on predatory mortgage lending, and we all came to the agreement that we would be working on this issue in the interim.
on this broader issue of predatory mortgage lending. Do you think this issue here that we're talking about, and we've got file and pages and pages and pages of, could be dealt with in that work group in the interim?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, I think if you recall my earlier testimony, the last time you had a work session on this, I indicated that to the extent the bill addressed a problem, we were okay with it. It was not our bill. I think probably our position would be on the issue of whether or not this goes to an interim committee just about the same. That may be a way of finding out exactly how to address the problem. It's just the committee's choice, and we're not taking a position pro or con on that.
And I have one final follow-up, if I could. Mr. Krueger, there seems to be a lot of people that have been exempted out of this bill to get it to an acceptable agreement for everyone. Do you think the bill's effectiveness has decreased because so many people have been exempt?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, relative to the Dash 4 amendments, I don't believe that it would have a major impact because so few people are currently licensed that are mortgage bankers who would have loan officers that fall into that provision. Most mortgage bankers are excluded from the definition because they are a financial institution or an affiliate or a subsidiary of a financial institution. Therefore, the numbers of mortgage bankers that we have licensed under the Act are relatively small, just a handful, and the number of loan officers that they would employ in total would be fairly insignificant in the overall. The Dash 5 amendments, however, would have a much higher impact. It would take out, as Mr. Cosgrove says, approximately 30%. I do have another insurance company which is licensed as a mortgage lender in the state of Oregon. All of their loan officers would also be exempt under the Dash 5 amendments. So it could be as high as half as many people falling in the soup if the Dash 5 amendments were approved.
Thank you, Mr. Krueger.
Representative Johnson?
I'm going to echo something that Representative Walker just said about the hope that we can continue to work on this. It seems as though you're moving closer, but we've got the same situation right now. Mr. Cosgrove can't support the bill without the Dash 5s.
Correct.
Mr. McCulley can't support the Dash 5s. Mr. Krueger seems to indicate that the bill gets less effective. I'm just trying to figure out, is there any opportunity to continue working on this, Mr. McCulley?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, the Dash 4s, we believe, as has been testified, strike a very narrow exemption. Very few people are exempted under the Dash 4s. So we believe that adoption of those, I think, still have a significant impact on some of the issues that you've heard about throughout this debate. As far as the Dash 5s or any other group that would want to come forward to be exempt, I think at that point, yeah, you do weaken the overall structure that is attempting to be put in place here. I'm not sure, you know, how much further discussion can go, and you get to a point where I guess you have a bill that doesn't do anything if you exempt enough people out. We were willing to work with the bankers because of the close association we have. We're both licensed under the same Chapter 59 and believe that there were opportunities there after many months of work to come up with something that would be acceptable to both associations. Beyond that, to be perfectly frank, I'm not sure that there's a lot more that can be exempted out and still have something that's meaningful to protect consumers in the state.
You oppose the Dash 5s. I'm just trying to figure out at some point what problem are we trying to solve with a bill that has taken an enormous amount of this committee's time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I think that it has been pretty well articulated in some of the testimony that there are situations where loan originators are causing problems for consumers by falsifying information that is being taken. We believe that even though the total number of complaints are small, the impact, the number of people who are involved in those complaints, as you heard at the last work session, is very large. There is a great support among the industry itself. I'm talking about the real estate industry, as well as my own profession, to do this type of thing just because of the problems they see that are out there. So I think you are accomplishing a great deal.
Mr. Chair, respectfully, I'm not sure that the letter that we have in our pocket from the realtors exactly indicates huge support. They're saying, go out and work this out, and don't be coming to the legislature and asking us to solve this problem. And clearly, to move on the bill now without the dash fives the way you want it, Mr. Cosgrove's group is severely aggrieved. So I take exception to your characterization that there's wide industry support.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I was referring to, I'm going to say at least 100, maybe more, individual realtors who responded, and I think I distributed information to every member of the committee related to those individual realtors who supported this measure because of the issues they were dealing with in their own businesses. The association itself, in their correspondence, did ask that the bankers and brokers get together and work out a solution, and we are bringing that solution to you in the Dash 4 amendment. So we believe that we have met what has been requested.
Representative Bates?
I'm going to ask this question to Mr. Krueger, Mr. Chair, and I think he's the most neutral one to ask it to. Do you know of any instances when the group that Mr. Cosgrove represents has been a problem as far as originating loans is concerned?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, I've had no complaints against the people that work for the group that he represents.
Second question to Mr. Cosgrove. As I've looked at this thing over the ensuing months, and I think we're all kind of sick of it up here, to tell you the truth, to a certain degree, I'm still wondering if this bill really gets to the heart of the problem, which is rogue originators doing things they shouldn't be doing, which are fraudulent. I think this bill might help that to a degree, but I don't think we should kid ourselves it's going to solve the problem. However, seeing everything in balance, you're kind of a new player in this. You're maybe a little more neutral than some of the others. Do you see any value in this bill at this point if your dash fives go through? Are we still going to be starting to address a significant problem, even though we know it's not going to solve the problem?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, the people who would be left in the bill are the bill people, the loan originators, who are not licensed or supervised by any state agency or federal agency. The people who would have been exempted by from where the original bill went to the dash threes, the dash fours, and the dash fives are all people whose loan originators are supervised directly by some other state agency or federal agency with respect to their honesty, integrity, prior convictions, all of those things. So, yes, you would be continuing to register the group of people who are now not supervised directly. I just point out one of the reasons I think that at least we believe we have not had our folks have complaints, as Mr. Krueger mentioned, is our company has done an undertaking of responsibility, which is because our folks don't take any money for trust account. We don't have to have a trust account. We don't accept any money from consumers. All of that's paid to the financial institutions to whom we refer them. But that means that we are also, as a company, very clear, since we have been on the line for making, for whatever errors they make, that we are very clear that we closely supervise their work and oversee their work. And I think that's really what's necessary, is that the employers of loan originators need to do close supervision, review, establish internal procedures, all of those things. This bill at least reaches a group of people who don't have oversight by a state agency. Our point is we already have one set of licenses. Some of our folks have two set of licenses by this same department. We just don't want to have a third set of licenses.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The problem that I have with the Dash 5 is in the Dash 4s, I can see the relationship between the federal and the state. From the standpoint of federal banks, federal mortgage companies, federal Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, those connections I can see because of the tightness of the system, that they have. And the dash fives, I guess I'm having a hard time making the connection between the insurance folks and the loan originators. And I guess here's what I have to relate everything back to my own kind of experiences in some respect. Representative Montes Anderson is a licensed nurse. I'm a licensed athletic trainer. We have similar, there's some things that we do that might have some overlap. However, that's like saying, well, because I'm regulated by another state agency, that I should be able to be a licensed nurse just because, or that she should be able to be a licensed athletic trainer just because. And I can't quite buy the just because. And I think it relates more to the continuing education than it does the honesty, integrity, and that sort of thing. I don't think that doesn't become the question. So how do we resolve that issue, I guess?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, the legislature has already decided when it adopted this licensing statute several years ago that insurers are exempt from licensing even if they do mortgage loans. So we have the great irony here of if I were an insurance agent working for an insurer doing a mortgage loan, I would be exempt. And you can see that if you look at the dash fours, page 3, line 26, this is the list of all the people who are exempt from this whole statute, and it says an insurer defined in ORS 731. And assumably, I believe that means the employees of the insurer are also exempt.
Where was that again?
It's page 3 of the dash 4, line 26. It's the list of all the people who are exempt from the whole mortgage broker banker statute. And this is an insurer as defined in ORS 731-106. So if I am an insurance agent working for an insurer, I'm already exempt. The legislature has already decided it. If you pass the bill without the dash fives, you'd have the incongruity of an insurance agent working for a mortgage broker is covered, an insurance agent working for an insurer is exempt. We're just trying to get all of the insurance agents in the same playing field.
I follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I'm not sure that I would necessarily read that the same way, because this talks about, if you go back to sub 5 on page 2, line 6, it says mortgage banker, okay, means any person who compensation or in the expectation of compensation does all of these things. And then so what you're, I'm not so sure that line 26 necessarily is going to extend automatically to employees, because if that's the case, then I mean you could have the secretary, the administrative secretary for the chief financial officer writing mortgage loans.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I think it does for this reason. If you go back, as you were on page 2, where it says definition mortgage banker, and then you go down, well, it does not include, and it says a financial institution, which we're exempting by the purpose of this bill, and it has these other bank holding companies and all of these entities all the way down through insurer and retirement pension funds. I think if the employee is working on behalf of that kind of an entity doing job duties that they're not required to be licensed as a mortgage broker, I think that's how that's been interpreted, because I don't think Mr. Kruger can confirm for me that any of the loan officers working by banks have to have a mortgage broker license now. And that's consistent with how you're handling in this bill, where you're also exempting the loan officers from this special registration as loan originators.
So this is a mortgage banker, not mortgage broker.
Correct. I believe the same.
Okay, mortgage broker, and then does not include. And you have basically the same list.
It starts the same. I haven't looked down through that.
Well, sort of.
But in any case,
it does not. The same list.
It does not include that?
No.
Mr. Kruger informs me that insurer is exempt from mortgage banker, but not exempt from mortgage broker. So I stand corrected.
Say that again, Paul.
insurer, insurance company is exempt from the mortgage banker registration, not the mortgage broker registration, so I stand corrected. But in any case, I think the reason I mentioned that is I think the legislature has already made a determination in setting up this whole licensing statute that certain kinds of financial institutions doesn't make sense to have double registration, or in our case, in some cases, triple. That is our concern. And our registration, although it doesn't deal with the continuing education for mortgage loans as required by a state entity, it most certainly does internally for us, because you recall we're the ones who are responsible for those folks, and if they make a mistake, we're the ones who have to both answer to the state and to the aggrieved consumer in court, perhaps. So it's not as if there isn't continuing education. It just wouldn't be state required or mandated continuing education.
Okay. Then follow up, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kruger, is this good? Because if you read line 11 through about 14 and a half on page 1, it says loan originator means an individual employed by or purporting to act as an agent or independent contractor for a mortgage broker or mortgage banker. Since insurers are exempt from mortgage banker, then wouldn't that automatically exempt their employees, as Mr. Cosgrove is looking for here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, if they're employed by a insurance company who is funding loans and therefore meeting the definition of mortgage banker, then neither the company nor their agents would be required to register or be licensed with us. And there are many insurance companies who do a great deal of business in funding mortgage loans. There are other insurance companies like Paul's client who do not fund the loans necessarily. They might, but who more likely will broker the loan to another lender. And those people would be in the definition of someone who needs to be licensed and in the definition of someone who needs to be registered, unless you don't go with the Dash 5 amendments.
Thank you. I'm done.
Ms. Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kruger, I'm looking through my file here at Bob's and stuff, and I got to tell you, I've got another stack upstairs that wouldn't even fit in the file. But one of the things it says here is a loan originator is an individual employed by a mortgage lender, and it goes on. A loan originator cannot operate by themselves independent of a mortgage lender, can they?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, that is a question that we receive frequently from the industry and from loan originators. The industry would prefer that they be treated as independent contractors. It really is an issue for the Internal Revenue Service and the Department of Revenue for the state of Oregon. For purposes of enforcing our law, we take the position that you can call your agent whatever you like, but you're going to be responsible for what they do. If they call them an independent agent, that is not really part of our problem. That's a revenue problem or an IRS problem. And I can add that it's my understanding that both the Internal Revenue Service and the Revenue Department have taken the position that there is no carve-out for mortgage people who are loan officers working for mortgage lenders as independent agents.
So if I'm understanding this, then a loan, you can't put yourself out there as a loan originator all by yourself. You can't hang out a shingle and say, I'm a loan originator. You have to partner up with some kind of a mortgage lender. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, exactly.
Bingo.
Administrative rules confirm that and require that they work on behalf of only one licensed mortgage broker or banker at a time.
So there is an employer who's watching over this person, whether they're an independent contractor, however they want to qualify them or not. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, yes.
That's what I understood. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Knapp.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2764.
Representative Knapp moves the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2764. Are there any objections?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Devlin.
I would actually prefer the Dash 5s, but I understand there are there may not be the votes on the committee for the dash five. I think we're in a situation where we've got two groups that have been working on this with the committee for over 2 months, and we've got a new issue that's come to the committee, which I think is addressed in the dash fives. I know we can't address that issue here. I just hope it's addressed on the Senate side.
Okay, thank you. Representative Montes Anderson?
Mr. Chair, and I would hope that the exemption process could be looked at and clarified, and would hope that what was covered in dash five could be the people go through the who are concerned or who are brought to light here in amendment dash five could possibly go through the process of the waiver.
Okay.
Exemption or whatever the process is called.
Okay. Any other discussion or objection? Representative Bates?
And Mr. Chair, I really prefer the dash fives too, but as good Representative Devlin has said, I don't think we can get them through right now. I'm concerned that we're putting another layer of bureaucratic requirements onto a group of people who have never had a complaint against them, and that kind of concerns me. Overall, I don't think this bill is going to do what we hope to do of cleaning up this industry as far as rogue originators, but it's a step in the right direction. For that reason, I'll vote for it.
Okay. Is Representative Johnson?
And it's for actually all those same reasons that I'm going to vote against it.
Okay. Right now, the objections, there are objections to, I mean, I've heard comments. I haven't heard an objection. So if there's an objection, please state it now. Representative Johnson, Representative Walker,
you're
both objections. You're not an objection.
Excuse me. Yes, I object. If we're going to pass anything, it's got to be.
You object to the dash fours?
Yes.
Okay, Representative Johnson, you object to
the dash fours.
Okay. Any other objections? Okay, thank you. Okay, so ordered. Representative Canope?
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2764 as amended to the floor. Would you pass recommendation?
Representative Canope moves House Bill 2764 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion?
Yes.
Representative Walker?
I'm a vote. Like I said, this file is huge. We've been inundated with paper. Today we're presented with a new issue, though I knew about this late last week. I'm not willing to pass this bill out of here over to the Senate to work on this because it's a huge issue. It's not a minor glitch. And I've been looking through my file, and Mr. Krueger answered my question. It's still, for me, the employer is the ultimate person responsible here. This one person wrote me and said individual loan officers need education, and the businesses who employ those loan officers need a way to find out if the loan officer is a bad egg with a history. Well, if these people would start reporting these folks, that might go a long way to solving this problem. Instead, we're going to set up this huge system that's going to cost a whole lot of money, and I'm just not there. I think Mr. McCauley's done a heck of a lot of work on this bill, but we ought to just dump this over into the predatory mortgage interim work group and try to get these issues resolved, because I don't think we're there.
Okay, thank you. Other discussion? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to support the bill. And it's been one of those things that I've really taken a lot of time to look over. One of the things that I am kind of wondering, though, is that if the insurance folks wouldn't already be able to be exempted by rule or by order, and the reason why I say that is because when you look through the exemptions under mortgage banker and mortgage broker, the same line about exempted by the director by rule or order exists. I think that if the insurers are exempted from mortgage banker law or licensing requirements, maybe there's not a reason for them not to be also exempted from mortgage broker language, which then of course would in turn exempt them from the loan originator type of license. I have a problem making the connection, as I talked about a little bit earlier. But I think that overall the bill has come a long ways. I know that there are a lot of folks that are exempted, and I'm concerned about that also. But I can at least make the connection because there's another body that's a public agency looking over them. So with that, I will support the.
Thank you, Representative Crummell. Other discussion? Representative Bates?
Just real quickly, Mr. Chair, I'm going to vote for coming out of committee, but I would change that vote on the floor if I wasn't assured that the dash fives get fixed on the Senate side. We'll hear more about that, I think, if I get to the floor. If I felt that we were really focusing on the people that need this as a step in the right direction, I do it, understanding this does not completely solve the problem.
Any discussion? Okay, and I'm going to support the bill with the motion that's been made for a number of reasons. First, if you consider Representative Walker's concerns, I think you could express the same thing about the realtors or the insurance agents. I mean, they all have individual licensing requirements, education requirements, disciplinary procedures. Most of them work for another company, but they still have to individually get licensed to be able to serve the public effectively and honorably. And I think this is very, very similar to that. So I don't think it's just a question of keeping the employer accountable. I think there's also good things in this bill that require the employees, the individual mortgage brokers, just like an insurance agent, just like a realtor, to have continuing education, to meet certain standards, to have disciplinary procedures and so forth. Secondly, we talk about the cost, and the cost here is, what, $150,000. Well, we've got fees built into this that are $200,000. That are going to be paid by the people that are being registered. And they've come to us and they've asked us for this registration system. So I don't see the cost as being an objection. I think this bill, on when you weigh it in total, it is good for the public. It's a pro-consumer bill. It's a registration, education, disciplinary requirements. I think Mr. Cosgrove's concerns may have merit. Frankly, I'm really not sure yet, but he's come into this process extremely late, and as the committee knows, we've been weighing this issue for a good 2 months. I was pleased to see the mortgage bankers, the mortgage brokers, find a way to come up with language that addresses both of their concerns. I was very uncomfortable with the conflict we had there. I think this has resolved that conflict, and I feel very good about that. So I think it's appropriate to let this bill go forward. Hopefully it'll pass in committee today, and it'll pass on the House floor, and it'll go up to the Senate. Be another opportunity to look at some of these issues that Mr. Cosgrove came up with, and of course we'll have to go to Ways and Means at some point. But in view of the fact that the fees will be raised are greater than the expenditures, I don't think that should be a problem. So for those reasons, I'll support the bill. Dan, would you go ahead and call the roll, please?
Representative Bates?
Aye.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Excuse.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Knope.
Aye.
Representative Crummell.
Aye.
Representative Monis Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Walker.
No.
Representative Witt.
Aye. House Bill 2764, as amended, goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and the chair will carry the bill. Close the work session on House Bill 2764. I'm going to open a work session on H.R. 1. Dan, would you overview the bill, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Resolution Number 1 urges the Speaker of the House of Representatives to extend the Public Contracting Law Revision Work Group during the interim period following the 72nd Legislative Assembly. During both the 97-98 and the 99-2000 legislative interim periods, the Public Contracting Law Revision Work Group submitted a number of measures in order to upgrade and update Oregon law in public contracting. Legislative measures have been approved by the 2001 Legislative Assembly, which may provide enhancements for public contracting parties in the areas of subcontractor disclosure, bid protest procedures, exemptions from competitive bid procedures for existing government contracts, and inclusion of a least cost policy in public contracting. Areas still requiring attention from this volunteer coalition include distinguishing between suppliers and general construction contractors in certain areas, consideration of model contracting rules from the American Bar Association, inclusion of specific requirements for minority and nonprofit public contracts, potential improvements to processes for making claims on performance bonds, and continued formation of alternative contract award criteria for certain public awards contracts. Over 60 volunteers from private enterprise, along with legislative analysts and an economist, formed the 99-2000 work group, which had a minimal fiscal impact to the state during the past biennium. Below that, staff measure summary, should have a copy of House Resolution Number 1. And, Mr. Chair, we have four people to sign up to provide testimony on House Resolution Number 1.
I think the explanation would have been short if you just read the resolution, but we'll have Dugan Petty, Mark Williams, and Bill Penhollow.
Okay.
Chairman, for the record, my name is Dugan Petty. I'm the Deputy Administrator with the Department of Administrative Services. I have with me today Mark Williams from the Department of Justice. The Department of Administrative Services recommends passage of this resolution. The laws guiding our public procurement process have really been cobbled together over the years and are no longer effective in protecting the public's interest in accountable and effective procurement. Sections of the statute may have been effective in years past, but we've had change by change by change overlaid on the statute, and it's no longer accomplishing those intended purposes. The conflicts and some of the unintended consequences of the statute will be highlighted by Mr. Williams in his testimony. Over the years, the marketplace has changed. 30 years ago, we were buying correcting typewriters that were replacing whiteout. Now we're buying complicated procurement systems. Our procurement statutes have not kept pace with that. Public agency procurements should be accountable, not just for process, but also accountable for outcomes that accomplish the agency's mission in the light of the markets they're operating into. ORS 279 is largely driven by public improvement. And while it works well in the area of public improvement, it is not effective in the area of information technology procurement or provider service procurements or other types of procurements. During the 1999 and the 2000 interim, Representative Loken, the chair of the House Agency and Performance Operations Committee, asked Representative Wells to chair a work group to look into state contracting practices. That group came up with two law changes. When Representative Wells asked him what changes needed to be made to improve public contracting practices, the group overwhelmingly said it's time for a review and a rewrite of this statute. After reviewing the American Bar Association's model procurement code, the group developed a conceptual framework, which you have in the attachment in front of you. The group wants to see a statute that is integrated, that has different sections of the statute that work well with other sections of the statute. Right now, our current law doesn't work well, and there's not a thought towards an outcome at the end. It's been pieced together. Over the years, these band-aids have done little to improve the process and make it more accountable, but really have caused more delays and made it harder for people to carry out those sections of statute. What this resolution does is it involves a group of interested stakeholders in a thoughtful revision to Oregon procurement laws, and it sends a signal that the House of Representatives concurs with a rewrite, believes it's timely, and is needed. Also sends a message that the Public Contracting Law Revision Work Group is the forum to address changes in the procurement statute. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd urge you to pass this resolution and become involved in this rewrite. I encourage you to channel stakeholders to participate in this forum and to make Oregon's public procurement process simpler, more accountable not only to process, but accountable to outcomes that are calculated to be effective in the marketplace we're operating in, and to make Oregon procurement more effective for all who are involved with it. Introduce Mark Williams.
Good afternoon, Mr. Vice Chair, committee members. I'm Mark Williams. I'm an assistant attorney general in the business transactions section. DAS has requested that I speak regarding some of the technical problems with ORS Chapter 279 in support of the rewrite. As Dugan said, Chapter 279 has been amended many times and has caused it to become a patchwork of inconsistent and disjointed laws. It makes interpretation and guidance difficult for attorneys and must frustrate lay people who draft our public contracts on a day-to-day basis. Well, I need to be a little circumspect about the specifics of DOJ's interpretative issues with Chapter 279. I think I can highlight some of the issues. For example, Chapter 279 has multiple and sometimes inconsistent definitions for the same or similar terms, such as the definition of public contracts, public works, and public improvements. It is simply not an integrated public contracting statute, but more a collection of statutes without a coherence and overall structure or philosophy. Another issue is the scope of Chapter 279. It begins with a broad statement allowing for effective, a number of methods for effective public contracting. However, it never follows through with that in the rest of the statute. The statute pretty much is a public improvement, price-based statute, and fails to recognize the many varieties of public contracting that should be available to the state to meet the needs of, for example, information technology contracting. Another example is the sections of unintended consequences of the sections of ORS 279.310 through 322, which sets forth certain required conditions of public contracts. Many of these conditions relate to hours of labor and wages. While appropriate for a public improvement contract in Oregon, they have little relevance in a software contract for software developed in New York State. I spent many hours negotiating with IBM's lawyers about why Oregon wage and hour laws should be in their contracts. In my own personal commentary to this is I've practiced law for nearly 21 years in a variety of areas, private, corporate, federal government, including such topics as federal tax and federal banking laws. And this is one of Chapter 79 is one of the more challenging areas I've ever had to work in. Further, there's a hidden cost to the statute, short of just the frustration of working with it, and that is the cost that all the state agencies, local governments, and private parties have to pay to involve people like me to help them understand the laws. It really needs to be simpler, and we need to spend less time advising clients how to comply with the statute than drafting better contracts for the state. Which also provides me with a segue that my superiors wanted to talk about, and that's the other cost. The Department of Justice has about 15 attorneys in its business transaction section. We live and breathe 279 all the time. Our advice would be crucial to the development of this statute. We estimate that it would cost about a 0.5 FTE to be involved in this process going forward. That cost is, while it seems high in no relation to my particular salary, is $138,886 a year. Do you have any questions?
Questions? I'm sorry, I'm not sure who all is testifying. Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Penhollow, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. We are in support of H.R. 1. I concur with everything that's been said by Mr. Petty and Mr. Williams. Would just add that the last comprehensive review and revision of ORS Chapter 279 was in 1975. And since that time, every session of the legislature has added to, deleted, and modified various provisions of this important public contracting statute. And we feel that the effort that was started in the 97-99 interim and then continued into a broader scope in the last interim needs to be continued into the next interim so that the product that Mr. Petty talked about can be brought back to this legislative body for a consideration and action upon. So I would encourage you to support this measure and pass it on to the House floor. I also have the authority to indicate to you that representatives from the League of Oregon Cities and the Special Districts Association of Oregon were here earlier but had to leave and are likewise supportive of this measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Who has been, Bill, who has been on these interim work groups? Last couple interims.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, these work groups have operated under the interim committee, House Interim Committee on Agency Performance and Operations, and Chair Loken in the two previous interims appointed in the 97-99 interim former Representative Dennis Luke to chair that work group, and in the last interim it was former Representative Larry Wells. And there have been representatives from public and private sector. I think there have been
in excess of 60 or 70 various individuals participating in this process over the interim. I think there has been an effort made by former Representative Wells to involve all interested parties, not only from the public side, but also from the private sector side, to bring them together in a collaborative way so they could sit down at a table, much like we're doing here, but have a give-and-take interchange on really section by section of the Oregon Revised Statutes, Chapter 279, and developing recommendations for, if you will, increasing the user-friendliness of that particular chapter. And the material that Mr. Petty provided you earlier is kind of the outline that we developed this last interim, and is the outline that we would propose putting the meat to, if you will, filling it out and basically organizing 279 into a chapter that is divided into its various components: public improvements, purchase of materials and supplies, personal services contracts, and so forth. Hopefully make it much easier to use, Mr.
Well, it seems to be that the people who were the work group attendees, and I think this is in the, this was the 97-98 interim,
mm-hmm.
seems to be very, very heavily tilted towards the public sector. Is that accurate?
Certainly was in the first biennium of work, and the second biennium of the second interim, Mr. Chair, we attempted to get more involvement there from various public sector groups, but I would have to say that the predominance of participants were from the public sector. Did I misspeak? I'm trying to get more from the private sector,
right.
But you know, I think it was predominantly.
Why is that? Well, I mean, why do we have such a heavy participation among public sector organizations and so little participation from private sector?
Let me respond to that, and maybe Mr. Petty would like to as well. We made an effort in that process with the assistance of Representative Wells and Representative Loken to identify interest groups that represent suppliers of materials and services. The contractors on the public improvement side, I think, were quite well represented. We had both the AGC and ABC organizations represented in those discussions, but we attempted to get Associated Oregon Industries and the Oregon Retail Council involved, but were not as successful in that effort, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, my sense is that part of the reason for the group of people who worked on it last time, it was to some degree the carryover list from the time before. I think the group recognizes that it's important to make this even broader, and as they deal with different contracting marketplaces and different contracting outcomes, to bring in all the stakeholders that are involved in that process. If what we come up with only works for a small segment of the stakeholders, then it doesn't work. It really fails. So I think it's important that it be broader and more inclusive. We began to start addressing areas like information technology, and we didn't get to provider service contracts. But when we did that, we invited state agencies in to talk about it, and we also recognized, although we were running out of time, that it was important to bring in the suppliers into that discussion. As part of the difficulty, and I think you'll find this from anybody who engages in this from the public procurement side, is if our processes are not effective in a given market, if we're in there trying to buy information technology with the wrong kind of procurement vehicles or have terms and conditions in it that are based on public works, as Mark has talked about, it doesn't work. And the people who can best tell us that are the people that are in that market, the people that are selling those products, and they really do need to be at the table.
Is the work group, the way it was constituted in the last two interims, was it statutorily defined as to who would be in the work group, or was it an open process that anybody could be involved?
Mr. Chairman, it was an open process. It was not statutorily informed. Some of those groups were noticed, and in fact, I believe they were all noticed. But for something like this, I think you really have to contact people and invite them to be a part of that process.
Does it make more sense to statutorily set a specific number of people to be on the work group representing different types of entities and organizations as opposed to having this open process?
Mr. Chairman, if you'll recall, in the last legislative session out of the work group, the first one, there was actually a bill that came out of that that tried to cast a group of folks, and I don't remember the numbers, but maybe it was 26 people, and that proved to be more problematic. I'm inclined to think that it should be open, and we should reach out and try to bring stakeholders in the process. There's a lot of work to be done here, and the movement really took place because there were a lot of volunteers working on this. We structured it in committees, and people were free to attend and participate in those committees. So I think having it open, in my sense, is a better approach to it than having it closed.
Any legislators other than, Representative Loken, can any other legislators participate in the work group?
Mr. Chair, with the working group, this last interim, it was Representative Wells, but the work group reported regularly to the interim committee, so there was that connectivity back to and reporting responsibility. Yes.
Okay.
And on your question, Mr. Chair, regarding specific groups to participate, I would agree with Mr. Petty that we want to make this as collaborative as possible to get as many people involved as possible. And in doing that and trying to keep the cost down, the fiscal impact to the state, we worked in a more informal environment rather than establishing a full-fledged interim committee, if you will, with representation, with persons receiving expenses and per diem and so forth. So this was an effort to keep the budget down and still get the work done.
How about how many of the proposals that came from the work group in prior to the 99 session or prior to the 2001 session have become law?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Pinhall may correct me, but I believe there were four proposals out of the not this current session, but the prior session, and three of them became law. The one proposal that set the work group up to rewrite statute didn't move forward, but it didn't move forward because of the fiscal impacts associated with that. In this last interim, there were two measures that came out of it. Both of them came to this committee. One of them was 2052, which has passed out of this committee, and the other one is, I believe, 2053, which did not pass out of this committee. Those were the only two, and those were deemed critical by the work group to move forward with those, but generally the consensus was we really need to, instead of doing this on a piecemeal basis, really get a hold of the entire code and rewrite that.
I agree that chapter 279, I think it is, needs a lot of work. I mean, I had a bill last session trying to deal with it. It can't be done quickly. I mean, it's involved, it's complicated, a lot of it's outdated. It really needs to be reviewed, I think, overhauled.
Mr. Chairman, I also might add that Dave Kanegi is with us from the Oregon Law Commission today. I believe he's with us in the audience, and they've also seen this and would have an interest in participating in that rewrite. So I think there is a broad group of stakeholders that would like to be involved in trying to tackle this in a more thoughtful way.
Thank you. Is there anybody else signed up for testimony, Dan? Okay, Jessica, do you want to come up? Committee, we're down to six, and we have one other. We have HJM 17 up that I'd like to move today, so if you can hang in there, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jessica Harris. I'm here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. Before you, or becoming before you here, is a document. Both my testimony and to give you just a glimpse of the work that we did this interim, a document that outlines some of the definitions that we spent hours going over, trying to consolidate four definitions of a public contract into one, be useful. In addition, a document that kind of outlines some of the different procurements that sole source and single provider and public improvements, and talks about how those ought to be procured or not. In our view, this is perhaps the most complicated chapter of the set of statutes that you receive every year, but perhaps one of the most important. In this statute is everything from how to buy a box of paper clips to how to buy a new bridge. And quite frankly, it's a little bit of a mess. And we agree and concur with everything that you've heard in the previous testimony, and I would add that, quite frankly, H.R. 1, while it doesn't force the committee to actually be successful in their effort, I think it brings people to the table. Last interim, we sat down to work on this issue. There were folks that said, well, is this really gonna happen? Do I really need to be here? Is this really gonna happen? It was AGC's position that absolutely it was gonna happen, and it was absolutely critical that we did it. And in our view, H.R. 1 gives legislative approval to this process and encourages people to show up. Other folks, my colleagues in the private sector, that need to be there and at the table as this process happens with them, I think this bill is critical in making that occur. Quite frankly, we believe that anybody and everybody at the table provides a good input, and we appreciate your consideration of this measure.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Senator Carlson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just out of curiosity, in terms of input and support of further movement, all of the characters that were in these other discussions that we've had here, do you have any sense of whether they're interested in doing this kind of work, if it meets their need as well?
Chair, members of the committee, Representative Carlson, I can't speak for the other characters that I have, so-called characters, I would not. Let me dig myself into another hole.
I set you up.
The other colleagues of mine who have sat here with me or sat behind me or in front of me this session, and we've debated those issues with vigor. But I think the discussions that we've had vigorously before this committee is exactly why we need this bill, exactly why we need this process. This section of statute, the entire thing, is fraught with inconsistent policy that doesn't make sense. And we need to sit down and look in a comprehensive format, what should the policy be? And then how do you write the rest of the statute so that it makes sense in supporting that? It's not so that you have, you know, one section of statute that says use a pink pencil when filling out the form, and another that says generally we ought to be doing sustainable stuff and that's a good idea. And I think that's what you have in 279, the pink pencil language and the broad policy, and we really need something that is more consistent than that.
Mr. Chair.
Paula?
And so would your work group be open to including the diverse interests? You might have said this before, and if you already have, I apologize.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, Representative Carlson, I believe that that's the only way that the work group would work. And I invite, and I believe it's critical that the rest of the industry come and sit down and discuss this stuff. I think that that is the only way that this process will be successful, and the only way that it will be meaningful. And I think the passage of H.R. 1 will say, you know, the legislature is serious about this process, and please show up.
Great, thank you.
Okay, any other testimony? Paul, did you want to testify? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on H.R. 1, and I'm going to open a work session on H.R. 1. Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I would recommend adoption by the House Resolution 1.
Okay. Representative Johnson recommends adoption of House Resolution 1. I think we need, don't we need a motion to move the resolution, or is that the correct language?
We need a recommendation that the House adopt.
How is that what it reads? Okay. I'm just clarifying. Okay. Representative Johnson recommends adoption of House Resolution 1. Any discussion? Okay, go ahead and call the roll, please.
Representative Bates, excused. Representative Brown.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Devlin and Garrard, excused. Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Canope.
Aye.
Representative Crummell and Representative Walker, excused. Representative Monis Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye. What do we need now?
Just a carrier.
We need a carrier, okay.
I move to put on the consent calendar.
That's a motion.
Representative Canope moves that the resolution be put on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? So ordered. Okay, I'm going to close the work session on HR1 and open a public hearing on HJM 17. Is there anybody here signed up to give testimony?
Mr. Hellman of the PUC.
Mr. Hellman. Welcome. Go ahead and give your testimony.
I'm Mark Hellman of the Public Utility Commission, and with me is Stephen Brown. Had an opportunity to look over House Joint Memorial 17 recommended its adoption, but I did have a couple of points to make, if I may. One is in the summary section. The second paragraph, second line, seems like if this language stays the same, it's for state of this union. I believe this was left out.
Where are you?
What line are you on?
I'm on the summary part at the top.
Oh, that's
not I don't know whether that part matters.
No.
Doesn't matter? Okay, well,
state of the union.
Forget that. I did want to make two comments on this. One is I wasn't sure what was meant by a state of this union, whether this was saying specifically California or is it any state that this clause could be assigned to. Seems to me that the thought on this is that if the federal government orders utilities to deliver power within a state, then either it's the federal government's or that state's responsibility.
All right, yeah, this, what you're looking at above the language is not part of the bill, as I understand.
Right, but you may also be referring to line 19,
yes.
Mr. Hellman?
Yes. Okay. Line 19.
Similar language.
Or a state of this union, so it could be any state.
Yeah, why do we want or a state of this union in there? Does it serve any purpose?
California could guarantee payment.
Well, the point is California can't impose a mandate on Oregon to sell power to utilities in California.
It would be my recommendation to take that out.
Yeah. Representative Knopf, do you have any problem with that?
Nope.
All right. The conceptual amendment we're going to consider here, members, is to...
Oh, I love conceptual amendments.
We're going to get rid of that comma after the word America on line 19 and then delete or a state of this union comma. Okay, so it'll read... We call upon the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States of America to enact legislation to require that the United States of America be required to guarantee payment for any sale of electricity. Because it refers to a utility being required under a federal emergency order or other federal mandate. So I mean, since it's a federal mandate, it's the federal government that should step up and pay the bill and guarantee the payment.
And that language is, I know it doesn't matter, but it is up on the top. There's one other comment I wanted to make, and that is that I don't know that you want to include it, but Federal Power Marketing Agency, in this case, Bonneville Power Administration, was also directed to sell any surplus power to California, and I believe that they have some millions of dollars still owing to them as well. And the Northwest customers pay the rates of Bonneville, and so if those bills aren't paid, well, then we have to pay it. I don't know if there'll be sympathy in Congress to have the federal government pay Bonneville. I think that's a different issue than perhaps utilities, but I wanted to point out that the Bonneville Power Administration in addition to utilities, was required to sell to California. And as of last month, they were still owing money.
Yeah, wasn't that an agreement where they're going to provide twice the power back as non-peak time?
They did both two-for-one exchanges, and they also sold power to the, at least I believe, the ISO down in California. I suggested that they continue doing the two-for-one exchanges and not do the money. But they are owed money as of a month ago.
Okay. I think the intent of this bill here is to deal with the sales that are made by Oregon utilities to California under federal mandate. And I appreciate you bringing up that point, but I think it's probably beyond the scope of the bill or the intent of the bill.
Right. I just want to bring it up. No recommendation on that.
Okay. Any other testimony?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Okay. Anybody else who wants to? Paul, did you want to give testimony on this one?
Oh, come on, Paul.
I know you've been dying to get up here all day. Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing and open a work session. Representative Johnson, did you want
to? You need to suspend the rules for conceptual amendment.
Okay. First of all, you go ahead. This is your memorial, so.
Mr. Chair, I'd move that we suspend the rules for the purposes of conceptual amendment.
Representative Knopp moves that we suspend the rules for the purpose of conceptual amendment.
He's holding us all harmless.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, on line 19, we need to strike the comma and for a state of this union comma and make it read that the United States of America be required to guarantee payment for the sale of electricity, lines 19 and 20.
Okay, Representative Knope moves the conceptual amendment that we get word of on line 19, we remove the comma and the words or a state of this union comma. Is there any objection to the conceptual amendment? That's ordered.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Joint Memorial 17 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as conceptually amended.
Representative Knope moves House Joint Memorial 17 as conceptually amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Okay, please call the roll.
Representative Bates, excuse. Representative Brown.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Devlin.
Excuse.
Representative Girard.
Excuse.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Knopp.
Aye.
Representative Crummell.
Excuse.
Representative Moss Anderson. Representative Walker.
Excuse.
Representative Witt.
Aye. House Joint Memorial 17, as conceptually amended, goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Representative Knopp will carry the memorial. Close the work session. And you had an announcement, Dan, for Friday?
Yes. Due to construction, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in this room Friday, we will be in hearing room B. I will send out an email as well as post an agenda that shows not only the date, correct date, but in fact the correct location of hearing room B on Friday.
And we have the agenda published for Wednesday and Friday.
We do.
We have that now.
Yeah, Wednesday.
Saturday?
No, that was today.
So you,
we have Wednesdays is out.
Wednesdays and Fridays are both out?
Wednesdays is out.
Wednesdays out, Friday will be out tomorrow.
Friday.
Okay. Very good. Anything else? Sure. Thank you.